what the example of the Black Utopians can teach us.
What we want to attain in the world is going to happen easily. It's never been true, and right now that is especially the case. But I think if you go into these next few years knowing that and understanding that, it may allow us all to adjust and try to go forward in some way.
That's Aaron Robertson. We talk with him about his fascinating book, The Black Utopians, Searching for Paradise and the Promised Land in America. It's about the hidden legacies of Black Utopian experiments and what they teach us about the power of community today. Then, Trump is taking a wrecking ball to every form of consumer protection we have, but the rot started long before him.
So much of the last, 40 years is the story of an economy that is increasingly overtaken by fraud that we just call business.
That's Cory Doctorow. We talk with him about his new crime thriller, the latest installment in the Martin Hench series, Picks and Shovels. It tells the origin story of forensic accountant Martin Hench and the most powerful tool for crime ever invented, the personal computer. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump is trying to erase Black History Month, but that won't fly on Writer's Voice. Every week this month, we'll be featuring books about key times in America's Black history, a history that enriches and enlightens us all. That includes Aaron Shetterly talking about his book Morningside, the 1979 Greensboro Massacre. Victoria Christopher Murray tells us about her novel of the Harlem Renaissance, Harlem Rhapsody. And Bernadette Atuahene talks about the history of how racist policies undermine Black home ownership in America. Today, we're joined by Aaron Robertson, author of The Black Utopians. His book covers the rich yet often overlooked history of Black utopian communities in America, places born from struggle, but driven by hope, self-determination, and perseverance. From the historic town of Promised Land, Tennessee, to the radical vision of Black Christian nationalism in Detroit, Robertson takes us on a journey through forgotten movements that sought to build a better world right here in America. Aaron Robertson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Your book, The Black Utopians, moves between personal history and the history of Black utopian experiments in the 20th century, although you do go back to one that began in the 19th century. I'm not sure you include it as precisely a utopian experiment, but I think that it really does fit the bill. Your grandparents had a farm in Promised Land, Tennessee. Tell us about that historic Black town and your family's association with it.
I definitely do count Promised Land as one of the many utopian communities that I write about in the book. So Promised Land was an all-Black town that was founded west of Nashville in 1870. So, you know, just 5 years after the Civil War ended. And this was a place that existed for about 100 years or so. And my grandfather grew up there. Like, he was born there in the 1940s. And although the population declined in the mid 20th century, this was always a kind of a space for familial gatherings. And I grew up going there as a kid. And I didn't really have an appreciation at the time for the historical significance of a place like Promised Land. It was one of hundreds of these all-Black settlements that existed across the United States. Not all Black families came from a place like Promised Land, which I would realize, like, as I got older, it represented for me the kind of historical starting point of communities that African Americans created in order to kind of escape, you know, so much of the sort of social and economic and political restrictions that had historically been imposed on them. I wanted to start from both a personal and historical place in order to tell a much broader story about similar kinds of communities.
There have been many utopian experiments in American history, but what makes these different is how they emerged out of such a history of terrible persecution, and persecution that continues through today. It's not as if that's just in the past. And in fact, you spoke with people, your book does center on those experiments that began in the interwar period, and then, you know, a lot of the book focuses on those that were in the 1960s, when there was, you know, the counterculture movement that emerged a lot out of privilege, not so much for those experiments that were in the Black community. So I wonder if you could address this. It's like a paradise built in hell, to use the words of Rebecca Solnit. Talk about this tension between how these communities emerged out of such terrible oppression. You know, how was their vision different? Just to frame the larger environment of these.
So I think that within American history, when people talk about American utopias, we tend to focus on two general time periods. One of those is the sort of early 19th century, like where you had predominantly, if not exclusively, white utopian socialist communities. So places like New Harmony and, you know, Indiana. We had also the kind of establishment of the Shakers, and that's one story. But then there's this sort of tumultuous period in the 1960s and 70s when you're seeing the explosion of all kinds of countercultural movements. A lot of us may think of the hippies and kind of the back to the land, you know, communes that were spreading in the 1970s. I had always been really interested in the history of American countercultures, but so much of the conversation about American utopianism seemed to leave out the experiences of Black Americans. I think that, you know, groups like the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam tended to be the ones that got most of the attention during that period. But there were so many other groups and so many other initiatives throughout the 20th century that I think embodied this sort of anti-authority, anti-capitalist approach to life that I wanted to explore. And so the main group that I write about in the book began in a Black nationalist church in Detroit called the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And this was a church, you know, founded by a revolutionary Black nationalist pastor named Albert Clegg Jr. And he began this sort of social and political movement that he called Black Christian Nationalism. And it was so fascinating to learn about, because here was a church that began in Detroit that would then go on to establish these Black communes, not only in Detroit, but also in places like Atlanta and Houston. This was a kind of quintessential American utopian community. But these narratives were not well known at all. And I wanted to explore like why that might have been.
Well, I mean, aside from the obvious ways in which I think American society doesn't elevate the voices of Black people in this country unless forced to, what are some of the reasons that you think these are lesser known?
Yeah, well, you know, in part, I think there's a broader answer, which is the way that people have been taught to think about utopia, right, as the kind of achievement of, if not, you know, a perfect state of living, one that is predominantly defined by a sense of optimism, by a sense of hope, right? Like that has usually been seen as contradicting the nature of Black American history, you know, writ large, right? We tend to focus, I think, on histories of, if not oppression, of, you know, great political struggle and social struggle. And all of that is there. But I think the attempt to, you know, create a better life, to create a better world, is also rooted in creativity and joy. But it takes a while for that narrative, I think, to take root. But in the case of the Black Christian nationalists, the period of American utopianism was also the period where new groups like this would often be monitored by government agencies, right? This was still a Black liberation movement. So they faced the same kinds of pressures that so many other Black nationalist groups faced from the FBI, from local police, etc. But there was always a kind of discomfort around groups that in some ways attempted to set themselves apart from the rest of American society, especially when those groups were religious in nature. So the Black Christian nationalists were sometimes, you know, misunderstood and mislabeled by the press as a kind of cultish community. That was not actually true. But I think, like Jim Jones' church, the People's Temple, that became kind of the face of American utopian experiments gone wrong, right? And I think that there was a tendency to conflate separatist communal groups with a kind of extremism that tended to push these groups to the margins. And that's what happened with the Black Christian nationalists too.
So talk about this term Black Christian nationalism, because of course we live in a time of resurgence of white Christian nationalism. So it would be easy, I think, for people to try to conflate the two. And I think what you're just talking about is how that might have even happened in the past. But they're quite different and came out of different traditions. So talk about those differences.
Yeah, very much so. It's funny because I started to write the book and to think of it in 2020. So this was, of course, before the insurrection happens in 2021 and before the term white Christian nationalism really takes hold. And as you said, they do come out of, you know, very different historical traditions. I would say that Black Christian nationalism, as Reverend Clay conceived of it, was intended to restore a sense of not only dignity among Black people, but also to encourage economic, political, and social self-determination. The mantra of movement was that nothing is more sacred than the liberation of Black people. And what that meant was not that other groups of people were somehow lesser, right, or not on the same plane. But in fact, it was attempting to, you know, to show African Americans that everything that they had been told about themselves was not true and could be resisted in really creative ways. Whereas white Christian nationalism is rooted in a long tradition of exclusion, of domination, right? If your identity does not align, like, very cleanly with white Christian cis identity, right, you pose a threat to the ideology of white Christian nationalism. And so it's very important to establish these distinctions between these two very different movements. And in a way, I think that Black Christian nationalism is the sort of antithesis of the very kinds of really dangerous ideology that white Christian nationalism represents.
Now, another difference, Aaron Robertson, that you point out in this book, The Black Utopians, is that Black Christian nationalism emerged out of Christian socialism, Christian liberation theology to some degree. So tell us about that.
So, you know, Reverend Clegg is often considered one of the great practitioners of what some people call, you know, Black liberation theology or Black theology, which at its foundation, there's this belief that God is a God of the oppressed, and faith and religious traditions, in this case, the Christian faith, is really one that is aimed towards improving the lives of those who have been dispossessed and disinherited. In many ways, it is a kind of radical imagination of what Christianity could have meant in the lives of so many people. It was an attempt to root Christian principles in the everyday lives of Black Americans. And that is also at the root of what I mean when I write about Black utopianism. It's not a belief in a kind of hereafter, like that is really abstract and hard to get a grasp of. It's about what are the sort of moral and spiritual ideals that can then guide pragmatic action. It sort of is a wedding of idealism and pragmatism. That is what this specific group, the Black Christian Nationalists, stood for. But that was also the kind of relationship, I think, between thought and action that I wanted to explore among various groups in the book.
Say more about that. What were the ideals of this movement?
Well, one, the Black Christian Nationalists were interested in establishing sort of independent Black-led institutions in all areas of life. So one of the issues that really motivated Reverend Clegg in starting in the 1950s on was improving the education of Black children, the educational conditions in which Black children grew up. Because, you know, in Detroit at the time, so many African-American children were going to schools that were underfunded, you know, where classrooms were often crowded and there was, you know, poor lighting. And this was a really unsustainable way, you know, for kids to grow up in. And so Clegg was always looking for models to adapt. He was looking to the example of freedom schools in the 1960s, but he was also, you know, looking abroad for examples that the Black Christian Nationalists could adapt. There were Cuban liberation schools and sort of Soviet Union, you know, kindergartens, even that Clegg and his people studied.
And the kibbutzim.
Yes, right, exactly. Most notably, the shrine looked to the example of the kibbutzim in Israel. And the point of that was to encourage a real sense that children could create their own sort of destiny, like in their own communities, if they lived together. And so this was like one example of many of how the Black Christian Nationalists looked not only within the U.S. to kind of explore different communal arrangements, but they also looked abroad, because so often it was hard, I think, for a group like this to feel that American values aligned with the kind of world they wanted to see. And when I say that, I mean this sort of emphasis on individualism and kind of capitalist accumulation, right? And even the, you know, nuclear family, right? All of these were things that Clegg, to a degree, took issue with.
You write that Albert Clegg didn't like the word utopian. In fact, he called it realism. He also promoted what he called a strategy of chaos. So I wonder if you could just explain those two ideas, that this is not utopianism, it's realism, and to accomplish it, they needed a strategy of chaos.
Exactly. Clegg famously disliked the word utopian because he identified as a part of this American pragmatist tradition. And what that meant is simply that there was no one way to kind of achieve the goals that he wanted for his people. And so instead of thinking, for example, that Christianity was the sort of height of, you know, moral ideals, and that those were the only precepts one could follow to structure their life, Clegg said, well, no, as a movement, we need to be open to all kinds of ideas and all kinds of movements in order to sort of shape the world we want. And so Clegg was inspired by the Nation of Islam, for example, because they provided, in his eyes, a very concrete example of a sort of durable, self-determining, like, Black nationalist movement. It didn't matter so much that this was a group that actually took a lot of issue with the Christian church, like with the very Christian church that Clegg grew out of. What mattered was the steps they took to attain material power and to build community wealth. And so, like, that is what Clegg meant by that. And he also was inspired by writers and thinkers like Frantz Fanon, who inspired this notion that Clegg had of chaos, right? Like, there needs to be a strategy of chaos in order to make the world you want to see. And what it means is you have to be open to improvisation, right? Like, you can strategize and you can try to build, to establish certain programs to guide your movement and your own actions. But the world does not work so cleanly, like, and it doesn't always align with the programs you lay out. And so there needs to be a certain amount of flexibility to the way you think. I think that Clegg was very skeptical of kind of sticking to one ideology, because that is so often the death of utopian movements. Like, when you cling so strongly to one way of life or to one way of being, but the times around you are changing and you are needing to respond to the world as it is, if you hold on too strong, then your movement will probably fade away. And that was a challenge that the church itself faced at the beginning of the 21st century. You know, Clegg died in the year 2000. And once he passed away, there was a real rift within the Black Christian nationalist movement. You had some people who still held on, you know, very strongly to a lot of the values that had been espoused during the era of Black power. They still wanted this institution to be, in a sense, a Black nationalist church. But you had other people who said, well, the world has changed now, and it's harder to create communes. This is a more globalized world, and our kids were not raised in the same way of thinking that we were, right? Our kids want to actually explore the wider world. And so there was a tension between those who wanted to hold on to the Black power like way of thinking and those who were attempting to explore something beyond that.
So this is where I was really reading your book, Aaron Robertson. I was reading The Black Utopians. I couldn't help but read it from the point of view of a more general set of lessons that we can draw in this time, very much because this movement did emerge out of, you know, it was almost as if suffering was the wellspring of hope and reimagination. And I think that for many of us in this society, far beyond the Black community, although it's going to be pretty intense for the Black community as well, we're entering into a time where we have to find a way through suffering to reimagine things. You know, many people said people who voted for Trump wanted to burn everything down. And that's a terrifying thought, but reading your book, I thought to myself, well, if you do burn everything down, then that does, in fact, give some room for alternatives. So what are some of the lessons that you draw from your own book as we move into this period?
Yeah. Like, what I've learned in researching and writing about these kinds of movements, you know, and speaking to some of the people who live through tumultuous social and political periods, like in the 1960s, is that at these moments of disaster or these real sort of turning points, as frightening as they can be, they also tend to be the same moments when these kind of utopian experiments really flourish, because there's a sense that maybe government or the kind of federal government or the way the world is trending right now that may not be able to provide always for your own family or your neighborhood or your city. There tends to be a real kind of turn to the local. And on the one hand, you know, it's sad and frustrating that we feel very atomized, like right now in this country. There is no real sense of unity, which is frightening. But also, I guess I personally feel really encouraged by the ways that like smaller scale communities are really embracing like mutual aid, are trying to provide for one another in very specific and tangible ways. It is hard to speak in terms of like lofty ideals for the future of our country right now. But I think that going forward, it's really kind of about attending to our neighbors. And that's the thing that's going to get us through what will be a very scary and harmful period in our country.
And Albert Clegg talked about acceptance of reality and preparation. And I agree. I think it's taking care of our neighbors that is really key. But what else might he tell us at this time for how we must prepare?
Clegg would say that the struggle is not going to end. And in fact, you know, like if there is one lesson about utopian ideals or even sort of orienting yourself towards the future, is that your work is not going to sort of end in one kind of glorious moment, right? Or like a glorious age of prosperity. But really, it is about finding the concerns in the world like that you have, that you can imagine yourself like constantly struggling for and constantly fighting for. I think we are so liable to be disappointed, you know, if we think that what we want to attain in the world is going to happen easily. It's never been true. And right now that is especially the case. But I think if you go into these next few years knowing that and understanding that, it may allow us all to adjust and try to go forward in some way.
And we can really find so many inspiring examples in your wonderful book, beautifully written. I mean, we didn't even talk about the letters from your father. I want to just say to our listeners that is a beautiful part of this book as well. So many wonderful lessons and lessons of the heart, the Black Utopians. Thank you so much, Aaron Robertson, for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Aaron Robertson is a writer, editor, and translator of Italian literature. The Black Utopians is out from Macmillan Press. Next up, Cory Doctorow and the Encrapification of America. Stay tuned after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. And now we're thrilled to welcome back to Writer's Voice one of the sharpest minds of the age examining the intersection of technology, capitalism, and digital rights. I am speaking, of course, of Cory Doctorow, best-selling author, activist, and blogger. Doctorow is known for his work in science fiction, journalism, and advocacy, tackling issues like monopolies, surveillance, and the fight for a fair and open internet. It's a fight he often wages in the realm of fiction, so he can reach the hearts, not just the minds, of his readers. Doctorow's latest book, Picks and Shovels, is a gripping thriller about the dawn of the personal computing era set in 1986. It's the third in this series featuring forensic accountant Martin Hench, who dives deep into the digital records of corporate America to uncover malfeasance. It's a prequel to the other two books, Red Team Blues and The Bezel, showing how Hench first entered the epic battle with the fraudster oligarchs who are creating what Doctorow calls the enchification of everything. Let's dive in. Cory Doctorow, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. What a treat to be back.
This book, Picks and Shovels, this novel, is, well, first of all, we want to say it's actually a prequel to your other Martin Hench novels, Red Team Blues and The Bezel. It's about the beginnings of the computer industry. They feature forensic accountant Martin Hench, who in the first book, Red Team Blues, is 67 years old. And I saw that you somewhere call him the Zelig of high-tech fraud. In Picks and Shovels, he's like 23, I believe. And we get to find out how he became a forensic accountant. Why did you want to make your main character a forensic accountant? And by the way, what is that?
Well, a forensic accountant is someone who looks at the books to figure out what happened. So forensics is figuring out what happened after the fact. So, you know, a forensic specialist might try and figure out what caliber bullet was fired into a hole in the wall, or they might try and figure out who hacked that computer and what instructions they issued to it. Or if they're a forensic accountant, they might go over the books and figure out where the money went. And there was a real kind of supercharging of fraud that came with the spreadsheet and more broadly with the digital computer. Mike Milliken, the junk bond king, he said he never could have done the frauds that he did without a spreadsheet. Remember that to do fraud beyond the level of, hey, can you give me two tens for a five? You need to keep records. You need to be able to know what you are claiming you have done and what you have actually done. And this is why when you see crime thrillers, they're often looking for a second ledger or a second set of books. Spreadsheets made that much more fluid. It allowed for juggling of much larger and more baroque kinds of scams. And when you think about the history of fraud in tech, mostly you hear about people who looked at the spreadsheet and said, oh, I can steal a lot of money with this. And I thought it'd be really fun to write about a character who looked at a spreadsheet and said, oh, I'm going to find a lot of stolen money with this. Because the fact is that even though a spreadsheet allows you to hide a lot more fraud, it doesn't necessarily hide it well. It can actually be pretty easy once you look at that spreadsheet to figure out where the money went. And that's only gotten more true with time. You know, early spreadsheets were pretty primitive, which meant that there was a limit to how much you could rip people off with them too. Modern spreadsheets actually retain things like edit histories. So we are seeing things like there was a researcher at MIT who ironically researched honesty. And she went in and changed her experimental data to make it look like something, her theory was true, and that her experiment had proved her theory when in fact it hadn't. And the reason we know she did that is because if you look in her Excel file, you can actually see the full edit history, and you can see that someone logged in as her with a copy of Excel registered to her name, went into these cells and manually changed the values to ones that created experimental proof of her pet theory. And so this is an amazing thing, right? People who commit crimes tend to be pretty hubristic. They tend to think that they're committing the perfect crime. They tend to think that just because they can't imagine a way for someone to figure out what they've done, that it's impossible for someone to figure out what they've done, when really it's only impossible for someone stupider than them to figure out what they've done. And oftentimes, as we're seeing with our current government, people who do crimes think that they are the smartest people in the world, all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding. And so it makes for a really fun set of adventure stories, not least because so much of the last, 40 years is the story of an economy that is increasingly overtaken by fraud that we just call business. You know, whether that's Uber losing $32 billion over 13 years in order to drive other taxi companies out of business, which is illegal. It's a violation of the antitrust laws of the United States, and then doubling the price of a cab ride. Or today, where the dominant way that hospitals hire nurses is through these apps that they call Uber for Nurses. And these apps buy the nurse's credit history from data brokers. And if they see that a nurse who's applied for a job for the day has got an overdue credit card bill, they offer them a lower wage on the grounds that that nurse is probably pretty desperate to get a job. And so that used to be called a scam or a fraud or a crime. And now, you know, as Donald Trump said in that 2016 debate, when Hillary Clinton accused him of cheating on his taxes, he said, well, that makes me smart. And so I wanted to tell the story of someone who thought, actually, this stuff is a ripoff. It is a crime. And to tell that story across all the different time frames from 1982 until the mid-2020s.
Well, you know, it's really fascinating because this book takes place in 1986. So it's not only the origin story of Marty Hench as a forensic accountant, but it's pretty much the origin story of the personal computer. Why didn't you tell us about that time?
Sure. Well, you know, if you look at the early days of any kind of gadget that is today a real commonplace, what you'll see is in the first days, no one was really sure what this gadget was. What kind of company was supposed to make it? Who was supposed to buy it? What shape was it supposed to be? Think of all the funny bicycles you've ever seen in old-timey movies. And of course, what you're supposed to do with it. And so I wanted to write about this period when PCs were not yet fully cooked, when they came in all shapes and sizes, when they could be quite weird, and where they reflected a lot of idiosyncratic ideas about what computers could and should be for. Because it was an exciting time. It was a time when everything seemed possible. Everything was up for grabs. You know, canonically, you had people like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak quitting jobs at companies like Atari and Hewlett-Packard and going off and starting their own businesses and putting these industrial behemoths in the shade with something that they cooked up effectively in a garage. It was quite an amazing and vibrant time. It was certainly before we entered the age post-Reagan of extremely lax antitrust enforcement, when we allowed companies to just buy each other, so that we ended up with what we have today, which is an internet, as Tom Eastman says, of five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four. And everything has become quite homogenized and janky in a bad way. Janky because the people who made it don't care. Not janky because the people who made it are still figuring it out.
It was a time also of great idealism around the personal computer. I mean, from what I understand, Silicon Valley in the early 80s, or maybe it was earlier in the 70s, but the whole computing, personal computer revolution, or the idea was to create this kind of radical democracy, unleash the imagination. It was, you know, there were a lot of pretty radical left-wing people who were involved. And, you know, your novels, this Marty Hench series, but of course, most of your novels, you know, really describe a process of what you yourself call enshittification. In fact, you have a book out, I believe, now. Came out in October. Is that right?
Yeah, I have just turned a book in. literally the last thing I did before getting on this call with you is exchange an email with my editor where he said, I know there's a couple of my edits outstanding in the margins, but I think we can call this book done. And the book is called Enshittification. The subtitle is Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. And it's coming out in October from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And there's going to be a graphic novel of Enshittification. And actually, the thing I'm doing after I finish talking to you, I'm going to be calling the illustrator adapter who's working on the graphic novel with me.
That's great. So let's talk about Enshittification.
Sure.
Why? How? How did this happen that we went from such, you know, really a utopian origins to such dystopian reality?
Well, I think the first question that you asked, why, that's the more interesting one. I can tell you how. The how is actually pretty straightforward. Digital computers are really, really flexible. And that means that the people who operate services that have a digital backend can change the logic of how that business operates. So that's things like prices, costs, discounts, search ranking, search results, and so on. They can make it so that every time you go into the store, everything is different. How the whole system works is different. And what that means is that it's really easy for them to slip one by you. You know, if you've ever seen a street hustler do the three-card Monty or the shell and the pea game, you know that what they're doing is moving their hands really quickly. And if you've ever seen someone slow it down for you, Penn and Teller do the trick, the cup and balls trick, really slow with transparent cups. It's one of their recurring gags. So you can see how the trick is done. What you see is that the trick itself isn't sophisticated. It's just fast and smooth. And the faster and smoother you do the motions, the harder it is for the mark to figure out which cup the pea is under, where the Red Queen is hiding. And that's fundamentally the mechanism by which companies are able to shift value, not just from end users. I think we focus a lot, rightly, on how badly end users lose when things change. You know, Uber doubles the price of a cab, or Amazon starts to rip you off, or Google is all ads now and it's hard to find anything good on it. And so we think about how the end users are suffering. But a platform, which is the dominant form of business in the 21st century, a platform mediates between end users and businesses. And it's not just the end users who get screwed, it's also the businesses. So those advertisers whose ads you're seeing on Google and everywhere else, they're paying four or five times more than they paid for ads just a few years ago. But the ad targeting is much worse and the ad fraud is much higher because the companies have dialed back the amount of policing they do of ad fraud. And so you can have situations like Procter & Gamble, which discontinued its annual $200 million a year programmatic advertising spend. Programmatic advertising is sometimes called behavioral advertising or surveillance advertising. It's when they target an ad to you based on something you've done, like doing a search or going to a physical place or buying something, as opposed to like a context ad where it's just like you're reading a fishing magazine and there's an ad for a fishing rod in it. They don't know anything about you except that you're reading a fishing magazine. So they zeroed out this $200 million a year ad spend, and they saw a $0 drop in their revenue because, to a first approximation, they were spending $200 million on ads that no one got to see. So, you know, we sometimes say, oh, if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. You know, the people who benefit from this arrangement are the businesses. But the businesses are also getting screwed in Enshittification. You know, it's not just that the cost of an Uber has doubled. The wage paid to an Uber driver has dropped by 50%. Right? It's both ends of this are getting screwed. And the reason I'm at such pains to explain this is that, at least in a limited sense, we are all class allies. All the users of platforms that have been shitified are class allies. Now, I want to get to your most important question, which is why. Now, there's an obvious answer as to why. If you're running a business, you're not running a charity. The more money you allow workers, suppliers, or customers to extract from the transactions that your business oversees, the less money there is to pay to your executives and your shareholders. But that's pretty easy to understand. And it doesn't have a lot of explanatory power because, as you say, the platforms used to be pretty fun to use. They were good. They weren't perfect, but they got the job done. Facebook used to be a great place to hang out with your friends. That's why we all piled in there. So the question really is why now, right? Why is it that all of these different companies are all going bad in exactly the same way right now. And I think the answer is that they used to have forces that kept their greed in check. So the first one was competition, right? They had to worry that if they treated you badly, you'd go somewhere else. And so they have worked very hard to end competition. On the one hand, they've done a lot of lock-in. So, you know, on a social media platform, the lock-in just takes the form of being in a place with a bunch of people you like. And as much as you like each other and as much as you hate the platform, you still can't agree on when it's time to go or where you should go next. So you just all end up staying there because there's no way to move en masse to somewhere else. But they also buy rivals. So, you know, Mark Zuckerberg bought Instagram. And when his CFO sent him an email saying, Mark, why are we spending $1 billion to acquire Instagram, a company with 12 employees and only 25 million active users, most of whom are not logging in most of the time? Mark Zuckerberg, in writing, admitted that he wanted to buy Instagram for an illegal purpose to reduce competition. He said, our users don't like Facebook so much that they're willing to lose each other to escape to Instagram. And when they get there, they don't come back to Facebook. And by buying Instagram, we can prevent them from escaping from Facebook. They can escape from Facebook, the service, but not Facebook, the company, and we'll still be able to extract revenue from them. And so they eliminated competition, and they did so because we stopped enforcing antitrust law. It's been about 40 years since antitrust law started to go into decline. It started under Carter, really accelerated under Reagan, and every president until Biden really just reduced the amount of antitrust enforcement going on in the country. Biden, to his credit, appointed some really brilliant antitrust enforcers at the Federal Trade Commission, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the Department of Transport, and the Department of Justice. And they did more in 4 years than their predecessors had done in 40. It was a remarkable 4 years. But, you know, look, we stopped enforcing antitrust law and we got monopolies. This shouldn't surprise anyone, right? This is like, you know, we had rats. We put down rat poison. The rats went away. Then a bunch of economists from the Chicago School said, hey, you don't really need that rat poison. 40 years later, the rats came and, you know, were eating our faces off. And these economists were like, how can you be sure that the reason we have rats is because we told you to stop putting down the rat poison? Maybe we have rats because, like, it's the time of the rat. Maybe, like, the alignment of the celestial bodies have caused rats to be enormously fecund. You can't be sure, but I'm sure. I'm sure that it's because we stopped enforcing antitrust law.
I just want to point out that the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau is being shut down as we speak. Lena Khan is...
She's gone. And Rohit Chopra, who ran the CFPB, is gone. Jonathan Cantor, who ran the antitrust division of the Department of Justice and secured a conviction against Google, he's gone. They have illegally fired the federal communications commissioners who were involved in preventing the illegal consolidation in the telecom sector. It's very bad. It's across the board.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with author and activist Cory Doctorow about his latest work of fiction, Picks and Shovels.
So, you know, you've actually led us nicely into my next point, which is that it's not just competition that keeps companies from turning on their customers. Sure, companies can be disciplined by the market, but they're also, and I think primarily, disciplined by governments. That's regulation. And the problem is that when a sector dwindles to just a handful of companies, they find it really easy to capture their regulators. You know, when there's 100 companies in a sector, they're at each other's throats. They can't agree on anything. They can't even agree on, like, where to hold a meeting to talk about their legislative strategy, much less, like, what to cater when they all sit down there. When there's like 5 companies in a sector, when they've all bought each other, everyone who's in the C-suite of those companies has worked with everyone else at some other company at some point. They're very cozy. And it's really easy for them to come to a single lobbying position. You can see this with the telecom sector and the oil sector and the tech sector. But broadly, this is across the board in our economy now because of such market consolidation. They basically neutered their regulators. And that's what we're living through right now. And not just here. You know, in the United Kingdom, there's a really excellent competition agency called the Competition and Markets Authority that has this giant digital markets unit with 70 full-time engineers investigating big tech crime. And they just fired the head of the Competition and Markets Authority and replaced him with the former head of Amazon UK. So you really couldn't ask for like a more henhouse guarding fox than this. And so regulation goes away too.
And we get tech lords becoming the de facto president of the United States with Elon Musk.
Yeah, that's kind of the ultimate in regulatory capture. But there are other forces that used to discipline these companies. So one of them, it's really distinct to technology. And it's related to that digital flexibility that allows companies to rip us off. Because there's really only one kind of computer we know how to make, computer scientists, we call it the Turing Complete Universal von Neumann machine. It just means every computer can run every valid program. So the computer in your digital thermometer and the computer that makes sure that you're using an approved brand of ink in your inkjet printer and the computer in your car and the computer in your phone and the computer on your desktop, they can all run all the same programs. I mean, some of them are obviously much more powerful than others and can run a program in a very short amount of time. And other ones might take a billion years to run that program, but they're all in this important sense equivalent. And what that means is that anything that a business does to enshittify its products can be disenshittified by another program. So if you have a program in your printer that checks to make sure you're using HP branded ink, you could remove that program and replace it with one that doesn't check to make sure you're using HP branded ink. And, you know, that may sound very intimidating to you if you're not a programmer. What I really mean is you could maybe go and get something in the checkout aisle at the CVS that has a USB port on it and costs 99 cents that you plug into your printer and that just overrides the program, right? I'm not saying you personally have to do anything, just that it's possible to write that program. And you could imagine that people might want to write that program because, you know, HP has raised the price of ink rather a lot. HP has raised the price of ink so much that it's now become the most expensive fluid that you as a consumer can buy without a special permit. It costs more than $10,000 a gallon to get colored water to stick in your printer. It means that you print your grocery lists with a liquid that costs more per liter than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winning stallion. And the reason that no one has written the program that allows you to use ink that costs pennies instead of tens of thousands of dollars is that these companies have not just captured their regulators in order to get rid of regulation, but also to create regulations that protect them from competitors. And primarily, these take the form of IP laws. So Section 1201 of the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act bans removing any kind of digital lock. So if there's a digital lock that checks to make sure that the mechanic who's fixing your car has paid $10,000 to Ford or GM and make sure they have an unlock code that has been given to them by the manufacturer, and you write a program to disable that function in your car so you can take it to a mechanic of your choosing, you have committed a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine for a first offense.
And this and so, actually is something that you are counteracting, however, with this book and others. You have an audio book of this. Talk about what Audible.com has done to you and how you're fighting back against this very thing that you're talking about, this kind of digital rights management law.
So digital rights management, it's what the entertainment industry calls these digital locks that they put on their products. So it's what stops you from, if you remember, if you brought a DVD home from Japan or Europe, you couldn't play it on your American DVD player. You know, you can't play certain video games on your PC without having an internet connection so it can check to make sure your license key is valid. Or you can't take your Audible audiobooks and play them just on a plain vanilla MP3 player. You have to use Audible's app for that. And when we said to companies, we are going to allow you to ask the government to put anyone who removes your digital rights management from your products in prison for 5 years, companies took that as an invitation to design their products so that using them in any way that their shareholders didn't like required that you first remove a digital lock and then commit a felony. And so they basically made doing things that displease their shareholders into federal crimes. And Amazon is a real pioneer in this. They have an audiobook division called Audible, They acquired them in an anti-competitive merger in 2008. Remember, I said we've stopped enforcing antitrust law. That's one of the consequences. And they have built them into a monopoly that controls more than 90% of the audiobook market, depending on the genre we're talking about. Particularly in my genre, they're indispensable. And they have a requirement that anyone who wants to sell an audiobook must put Amazon's digital rights management, its digital locks, on the book, meaning that it becomes a crime to take that book to an app that isn't provided by Audible, which means that if your customer, if your reader, your listener wants to leave Audible, they have to throw away all their audiobooks, which means that it's very hard to convince people to leave Audible, which means that Audible can treat you as a writer very badly and be pretty darn sure that you're not going to go anywhere else because your readers aren't going to follow you. And this is why a couple of years ago, there was a scandal called Audiblegate, where a forensic accountant like Marty Hench figured out that Audible had used an accounting trick to steal more than $100 million from independent audiobook authors. And the reason they did that is they knew they could, because the audiobook authors had nowhere else to go because the readers were all locked into Audible. So I don't allow digital locks to be put on my books, and Amazon will sell my eBooks in their Kindle store without the digital locks, but they won't sell my audiobooks without the digital locks. And because Amazon won't sell my audiobooks, my publishers don't want the audio rights, because if you can't sell on Audible, you can't make any money. And so I retain these rights and I make my own audiobooks. I go into a studio. I often hire famous actors. My books have been read by Will Wheaton and by Amber Benson from Buffy and many other great actors and voice actors who are really well known. I pay a great director to direct them, and I pay an editor to edit them. And then I sell them everywhere except Audible and Apple Books, because Apple also has this requirement that everything be locked to the Apple platform for all eternity and that the author can't unlock it. And I tried this for many years, and it was not hugely successful because everyone starts their audiobook buying journey at Audible. And if they don't find it at Audible, they assume there's no audiobook. But then I got the idea of pre-selling the book on Kickstarter and having a whole publicity campaign about the fact that you could pre-order the book and why you needed to pre-order the book, because Amazon wasn't going to sell it to you. And that's been hugely successful. I've just closed the seventh one of these. It came in at about $120,000. We sold a lot of books. We sold hardcovers and eBooks as well. I actually just working out now a time for me to go into the wholesaler, because we also accept orders for signed and personalized books. So I'm going to go into the wholesaler and personalize 600 or 700 books next week, and so they can go out in the mail and arrive on the on sale date with a personal inscription. And that process has been a way to not just raise awareness of what a scam this is from Audible and Amazon, but also to convince other writers to give it a try. The most successful is Brandon Sanderson, the blockbuster fantasy writer who walked away from Audible, sold his books in a Kickstarter, his audiobooks in a Kickstarter, and raised $45 million, which is significantly more than I think I'm going to raise.
That's incredible. Well, that's a wonderful story. And you are also selling the excellent audiobook version of this novel, this new novel, Picks and Shovels. So let's get back to that novel a bit. It presents your classic good and evil story. You have Martin Hench as a young forensic accountant goes to work for Fidelity Computing, which is run by an Orthodox rabbi, a Catholic priest, and a Mormon.
Mormon bishop.
A Mormon bishop, exactly. Three guys walk into a computer firm. Why do they hire him? And, you know, without giving too much a suspense away, tell us about what happens.
Sure. So yeah, it sounds like the setup for a joke, a computer company run by a Mormon bishop, an Orthodox rabbi, and a Catholic priest. But the joke is a pretty sad one. It's that they're running a Ponzi scheme, a predatory faith scam, where they use multi-level sales to get congregationalists to exploit their trust relationships and convince one another to buy these third-rate junk PCs that have been designed so that they extract as much money from you as possible over the life of the PC. So you can only use special floppy disks they sell you. They've even gimmicked the printers so that they only take a special kind of paper because they've changed the width of the sprockets on the old fanfold printer so that you have to buy special paper that costs significantly more than you would pay to get paper from anyone else. And they hire Marty because they have these three rogue employees who've gone off on their own. And they tell Marty that these three rogue employees have ripped them off and they need Marty to figure it out. But it turns out that what has happened is that these three women, an Orthodox woman whose family has kicked her out because she's gay, a Mormon woman who's left the church because of its opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment, and a nun who has left her order and joined up with the Liberation Theology Movement, which was a major force of opposition to the American Dirty Wars in Central America in the 80s. And as penance for having sold so many of these terrible PCs to people who trusted them, these three women have now gone into business selling kits to unlock people from this lock-in, to allow them to adapt their printers to use anyone's paper, to export the files that they made in the crummy spreadsheet program and use them with Lotus 1-2-3 and VisiCalc, and, you know, basically to strike at the locus of profits that these they call themselves the Reverend Sirs have on tap through this exploitative relationship. And Marty very quickly figures out that he's working for the bad guys, and he goes to work for the good guys. He goes to work for these three women and their company, Freedom Computing. And that's when he discovers that the kind of people who run a scuzzy little scam like Fidelity Computing are not the kind of people who take losing their profits lying down, and are in fact the kind of people who might resort to spectacular acts of violence to defend their scam. And so what starts as a trade war very quickly becomes a shooting war, and the stakes get really high, and the book turns into a pretty rollicking adventure story.
Like so many of your books actually do, which actually brings me to my next question, because there is a scene in the book where, you know, as you mentioned, this is a Ponzi scheme. This is a multi-level marketing Ponzi scheme. And you actually talk about schemes like that, one that the FTC did around Amway. And there's a scene where a group of victims of a Ponzi scheme are brought in and everything is explained to them. Exactly how they've been ripped off is explained to them, and they refuse to believe it. And I think this really gets to the heart of how do you actually, you know, bring the light to people? You know, I think your books and having adventure stories is a great way in. But it's a more serious question. How do minds get changed?
Yeah, it is an important question. And, you know, the fact that these are all people who are involved in faith and who have a source of knowledge that is kind of the revealed knowledge, the knowledge that you know to be true because of how it feels, really allows me to explore the way that minds change and the way that people's views change. You know, my friend Ed Zitron, who's a great writer on tech, he said that, you know, he lives in Nevada, he lives in Vegas, and he said that he used to write about crypto and try and convince people who were gambling on crypto, who were buying crypto, that it was a ripoff. And he realized that it was like going up to someone at a slot machine and telling them that the slot machine is a ripoff. And those people are just going to tell you to go to hell. Right? They know or should know what the deal is with the slot machine, and you're not doing them any favors by making them feel bad about being in its grasp. And I think we have all seen how crypto people know that it's a scam, but think that if they get into the scam early enough, that they can be one of the people who exit with the profits and not one of the people who come in later and are the ones who generate the profits for the ones who get out early. And there's the occasional person who does manage to escape with, you know, a bunch of profits derived from someone else's misery. But for the most part, the insiders are the ones that win, right? Trump coin is only going to benefit Trump. It's not going to benefit people who bought Trump coin. That is effectively impossible. As George Carlin said, it's a big club and you're not in it. Convincing people to change their minds, I think, is a long game. You know, fiction is one of the ways that I think people come to realize the emotional valence of arguments that have bounced off of them because they've been made only in the abstract or the intellectual way, that having a kind of fly through of what it would feel like to be enmeshed in a system that is aborning around you can be a way to put you on high alert and make you resolved not to allow that to come to pass. It's very easy after Trump gets elected to say someone should do something about this. It would have been better if a lot more of us had said something should do something about this before he got elected. And I think historically fiction's got a good track record for doing it. I know there's other ways to change people's minds. My dad has a funny story about how he was a fairly conservative, you know, moderately religious Jew who, had no interest in radical politics at all, and who had never lost an argument in his life. He was the smart guy in his family. And one day he and his best friend were walking down the street and they happened upon a picket line, and the picket captain was an organizer named Ross Dowson. And my dad picked an argument with him, and it was the first argument he'd ever lost. And my dad went back the next day and the next and the next. And within a month, he had renounced Judaism and become a Marxist labor activist, a thing that he still is to this day. Well, he turns 80 in a month. So I guess he was 19 when that happened. So 61 years later.
As a former labor activist, I can really relate. That's really great. Now, you know, we've talked about just how enchitified everything is, and it's just ramped up to a whole new level. But in spite of everything, it seems to me, I hope I'm not wrong, it seems to me that you are an optimist. Where do we go from here?
So let me tell you, I am anything but an optimist. I'm sorry to burst your bubble. And the reason I'm not an optimist is the same reason I'm not a pessimist. So optimism is the belief that no matter what you do, things are going to get better. And pessimism is the belief that no matter what you do, things are going to get worse. And I, as an activist, am a believer that what we do matters, right? That history changes based on human action. And that moreover, while as a novelist, I can easily plot a course from A to Z, and go from the place that we're at now to the place that you want the characters to be at in 250 or 300 pages. As an activist, I have no idea how to get all the way from here to the society I'd want to live in. And all you can do in the real world, in a non-novelistic world that is being massaged for narrative convenience, is try and find a move that will move you higher up the gradient towards the world you want to live in, on the grounds that if you can attain a higher vantage point, that you may discover from that spot courses of action that were not visible to you back when you were lower down on the slope. And the fact that you can't see your way all the way to the end just means that you're living in the real world. And so while I don't have optimism, I have a lot of hope, which is hope basically is the idea that I will try to make a move that will materially improve my circumstances in some small way, or the largest way I can think of, on the grounds that even if that doesn't solve any of the problems that I have, if it makes things just a little better, that I might be able to make things a little better still in a way that I can't see from where I'm standing now.
That's very moving, as a matter of fact. I think that's such a powerful prescription there, one that it's almost like, it's like meditation. You have to do it every day and you have to be here right now.
Yeah. You know, there's a joke from the East Coast of Canada, from the Maritimes provinces, whose punchline is, if you wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. Right. And it's true. if we wanted to get to a better world, this isn't the world we'd start from. However, this is where we are. And, you know, I think about, to get back to enshittification, you know, the last force that prevented enshittification over all the years that businesses were rapidly trying to turn their products into piles of shit without giving us a way to escape, the force that held the line was tech workers. And the reason tech workers were able to hold the line wasn't because they were in a union, it was because they were scarce. And they cared about their users, and they could tell their bosses to go to hell because they could get a better job across the street whenever they wanted it. And their bosses probably couldn't hire someone to replace them if they quit. And so that meant that workers just had an enormous power to hold the line and defend their users' interests. And of course, that's gone away because we had 260,000 tech layoffs in 2023 and another 150,000 in 2024. I mean, the reason tech bosses are so excited about AI and the reason they're trying to cram AI into every pore and orifice in your body at all times is because they want to fire workers and replace them with AI and have the workers who are sticking around be essentially quality assurance managers for AI-generated outcomes who can be easily fired and replaced by someone else so that they do whatever their bosses tell them to do. That's what bosses want. They want workers who do what they tell them to do. And to get back to a place where tech workers can defend their users, we're going to have to put them in unions because they're not going to have that scarcity advantage ever again. And when you think back on the history of the labor movement, you know, in some ways we just went through a golden age. The last 4 years of the labor movement, we had a government that, although it had elements that really cozied up to billionaires and business interests, also had objectively the most radical and effective National Labor Review Board of any National Labor Review Board since probably the Johnson administration. You have an all-time high interest in living memory in joining unions and an all-time high favorable view of unions among the public. Unions themselves have cash stockpiles larger than at any time. Unfortunately, union bosses decided not to use those cash stockpiles to organize those workers who want to be in unions. And so we finished the Biden era with fewer unionized workers than we started it with, despite all of those advantages. It's a huge wasted opportunity. It makes me sick to think about it. On the other hand, even as the National Labor Review Board is being dismantled, and it has been dismantled, I am forcibly reminded that the way that we got labor law was by having unions. We don't have unions because we have labor law. We have labor law because we have unions. It was the unions, the illegal unions, the unions that organized in the teeth of the most brutal repression that forced labor law into existence in this country and around the world. And the people who did that wildcat organizing, they did it in living memory. I mean, we are talking about 1935, right, where you get the National Labor Relations Act. Maybe it was 1934. I forget the exact year. There's people alive today who were teenagers with jobs when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, right? This is not the lost praxis of a fallen civilization. This is not like trying to figure out how to embalm a pharaoh or build a pyramid without power tools, right? This is doing something that our grandparents did, and then we can ask them how they did it.
And we have Sean Fain.
Sean Fain, who is a great leader, yeah, from the UAW, and who has called a general strike in 2028, and who's asking unions to set their contracts to expire in 2028. He was doing that because he thought we were going to have to play by the rules, because the Taft-Hartley Act, which is 1947, bans sympathy strikes, where one union strikes on behalf of another. So he said, okay, well, we don't need to have a sympathy strike. We can just have all of our contracts expire at the same time. We can all go out on strike together. But of course, we don't have to play by the rules anymore. There are no rules. Trump thought that when he threw away the rule book, that he would end the game. What he doesn't realize is he only ended the rules. Unions don't need rules. This is like the Grinch who stole Christmas, right? The Grinch goes down into Whoville and he steals all the tinsel and the baubles and the trees because he thinks that the Christmas decorations are what make people feel Christmassy. He's backwards. The reason people put up the Christmas decorations is because they feel Christmassy, which is why the Who's still have Christmas, even after the Grinch steals all their stuff. The reason we have labor law is because people want a fair shake, and they understand that solidarity is how they get it. It's not the other way around, right? People don't have solidaristic impulses because of labor law. And so if the impulse remains and the need for solidarity and union militancy remains, which, oh my God, does it ever, then we will still have strikes in unions. They just won't be legal, which means we don't have to worry about what the Taft-Hartley Act says. You know, Donald Trump can fold the Taft-Hartley Act until it's all corners and stick it up his ass at this point, because there's no reason to follow that law because he's not following the law.
And therein lies the very hope that you spoke of. Well, it's just been terrific to talk with you, Cory Doctorow. I mean, we could go on and on. I love the way you think. I love your incredible, prolific output of wonderful books and this latest here, Picks and Shovels. I hope you'll come back when your next book, Inshittification, comes out.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.